This is the Feminine Podcast, the official podcast of Feminine, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck Esme, editor-in-chief of Feminine.
And I'm Dara Cass, the other editor-in-chief of Feminine. So, Jenny, what are the announcements we have today?
Big announcements. The first one is that you need to mark your calendar because tickets are going to be going on sale for Fix 18 soon. March 4th is going to be the first wave of ticket sales. So get it on your calendar now so you don't miss your chance to get a ticket.
Yeah, we decided to do it on a Sunday at noon, figuring that this way most people would be available to try and get their tickets. We do believe that we are going to let the ticket sales, we're going to spread it out a little bit. So we're looking at putting it out for three Sundays in a row. The 4th, plus the 11th and the 18th, if my math is correct, and I know how to add sevens, we're going to release them in thirds on every Sunday so that even if you're busy or what's going on, you don't have to worry. We really expect that there should be hopefully a high interest for tickets. And speaking of that, if anyone is part of a department that is a Fix Foundation sponsor, meaning that the department itself has pre-purchased tickets for the conference as a commitment to gender equity. And so we have a bunch of Fix Foundation sponsors from platinum to silver and gold. Please make sure that you secure your ticket before the 4th so that we know how many tickets we have to release to the public. This is super exciting. It's actually really coming together. Jenny, we're throwing a party and it seems like people want to come.
I can't wait.
So that's exciting. And so now we can start talking a little bit about one of our talks from last year.
Yeah. So this podcast we've got today is featuring Jen Mitzman. So she's a lead pediatric educator at Ohio State University in the emergency medicine residency and in pediatric emergency medicine at Nationwide Children's. And her talk is incredibly powerful. It's called Break the Silence, A Lesson in Resilience. And obviously, resilience is something that we talk about in emergency medicine a lot. It's so important. In this talk, she goes into a really difficult case she had, and she so beautifully and openly shares how she got through it. I really think everyone out there is going to take something meaningful from their story, and I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that just before we go, I want to say that this talk resonated with me so specifically because we see so many crazy, horrible, heartwarming, heart-wrenching things in the emergency department. Yeah. And how we choose to process those emotions is really, really important. We need to develop the resilience and the tools and the network to be able to process these emotions in a really human way, not to ignore them, and to realize that they're going to affect our lives for a period of time. And so Jen really was honest about what this meant to her and how she got through it. And I hope that everybody listens to what she has to say and takes some lessons from how she survived and how they too can get through these moments. So we hope you enjoy her talk.
Today I'm going to talk to you about a time in my life that was very difficult, where I struggled with being a second victim in hopes of destigmatizing something that some of you may have experienced. My day started not very differently than many other days. I arrived at the apartment at 7 a.m. and took sign out, sent home my evening colleagues, and began my workday. Around 7:30, I got a frantic call from a nurse saying that they needed me in room X. I thought this was a little bit strange because this is not normally a room covered by my territory. It is where we preferentially deliver babies, although we try not to do that in our emergency department, and take care of pediatric patients. So I actually walked in there thinking maybe somebody wanted my help with a child. I did not see a child, but rather an adult male wearing a C-collar and nothing else. Someone was performing CPR on him, and my resident was getting ready intubation materials. A pharmacist and nurse were at the crash cart. I took a sort of brief survey of the room and stepped in to begin running the code. In between ordering doses of epinephrine, reminding my resident to pop the C-collar and optimize his view and some other things, pieces of information began to filter in. And I realized that the reason there had been no EMS in code for this patient and why he was mine rather than who would normally take care of that zone was because this patient already was mine. In fact, I had taken sign out on him, although we had never met earlier that morning, just before he tried to hang himself in our emergency department. I had to run the code, so I tried to sort of shove this deep down and continue my work. We were able to resuscitate him, although it was clear from his post-resuscitation studies that he was not going to ultimately survive. We got him stable-ish and upstairs to the MICU. And then I did what all of you have done in traumatic situations before. I went back to work. I shoved all of this information into a little box, and I went back to see all of the patients who had built up while I was in this one individual's room. There was some low-level chatter about the situation overall through the department and a few more people than usual who wear suits under their white coats, but by and large, my morning progressed not that unusually from many other days. Around noon, I received a call from the social worker saying that the parents had arrived and they had a lot of questions about why people were trying to send them to the medical intensive care unit when their son was here for a psychiatric issue. I too had a lot of questions about what had transpired that morning, but she and I went into the room to attempt to discuss what had happened. I told them what I knew and acknowledged that there was a lot of information that I still didn't know and disclosed to them, unfortunately, what I anticipated would happen with their child. At one point, I became a little bit tearful, and the mom reached over to me, took my hand, and said, "Honey, I've been waiting for this call for 15 years, and I'm really sorry you had to be the one to make it." I don't know as a person or as a parent how she found it within herself to give that piece of information to me. But that bit of forgiveness, I will tell you, was a very bright white light in what were otherwise some very dark times ahead for me. I went home for my shift, visited with my family, and told my husband briefly kind of what had happened, and I went to bed early, where I proceeded, of course, not to sleep a wink. I heard in my head over and over again the sign out information, the code situation, the parent conversation, and I reread the chart at 11 and 1 and 2:30 and so forth, looking for some piece of information that had I known it earlier, I might have been able to prevent this situation, or that somehow none of this had frankly ever happened. Of course, I did not find any such information. I was wide awake at 6 a.m. when my alarm clock went off and I had to go back to work. I don't know many things in life with absolute certainty, but I can tell you I had no business being in the emergency department that day, but it never occurred to me not to go. I know there are women in this room who have worked fevering, vomiting, laboring. You're out there, I know. And so I did what we all do, and I went back. I tried to take care of my new patients while being, of course, quite fixated on this previous patient. I had to step into several rooms to kind of recompose myself. I had hospital administrators who before that day would have never known who I was tell me, "Jennifer, the hospital is behind you and we understand exactly what you're going through," something we all knew was total BS. And to top it all off, my 3 o'clock partner, not known perhaps for being the most sensitive among us, walked in and said, "So I heard you didn't kill anybody today. Would you like to go home?" I was horrified. I felt literally ill. I gave sign out and went to my office to finish my charting slash secretly ugly cry, and I had a few visitors, all of whom male, interestingly, but three visitors, two of whom were partners I'm not particularly close to then or now, who came to share stories of patients that they had had under their care who either attempted or completed suicide. And one of them was our medical director, who said to me, "I've taken the liberty of making you a counseling appointment tomorrow morning. It's not mandatory, it has nothing to do with work, but what happened to you sucked, and I think you should talk to somebody." His words weren't that dissimilar from my husband's earlier the prior evening, and I thought, yeah, I probably should do that. So I did. I went the following morning, and for many mornings, afternoons, weird hours of day and night to follow for months, I worked through transitions back and forth from my components of my different jobs, through my first patient who tried to hang himself again in the future, and through the Grand Inquisition, otherwise known as the Sentinel Event Committee meetings. And in addition to talking to the counselor and to others, I did some research. And what I found was something that actually quite surprised me. While we are empowered from an early stage of our medical career to stop the surgeon who's about to lop off the wrong leg, and we should do that, while we do annual reviews of appropriate patient restraint, chemical or physical or what have you, in our department, 10 to 15% of annual sentinel events are triggered by a patient who attempts or completes suicide not while in the care of a medical provider who is not a psychiatrist, so inpatient or in the emergency department. And nobody ever says a word about this. I had no idea, and I bet many of you had no idea as well. So here I was in the middle of this brown, crummy pie, and I decided that I was going to do a little bit of work to change the conversation. Those two partners and the many people I have talked to who have been touched by this topic carry with them frequently a caveat. I don't talk about this, but please don't tell anyone else in our department or my department because they don't know and they wouldn't understand. And while I respect the silence of those individuals, I like to talk. And I knew that talking about this and talking through this was going to be the only way that I moved past it. I decided that I was going to talk to the students and the residents and to my colleagues, such as you all here today. And in doing so, I have been able to integrate this so that it is a part, but only a part, of my professional medical history. I know that there are people in this room who have been, or by the statistics, will be affected by patient suicide in the future. And I issue you an open invitation if you ever are in this round, crummy pie with me. But I also know that as physicians, we deserve to be able to talk about this kind of thing, not just behind closed doors with an individual counselor, but in appropriate public forums such as this. And I believe that when it comes to mental health, both for our patients and for ourselves, it is time to break the silence. Thank you for listening.